Today, Martin and I want to commemorate the upcoming anniversary of 9/11. And we have guests today. Andrew Bernstein is a philosopher of objectivism, and his co-host for their own podcast, Bosch Fosten, is here. Bosch is a cartoonist and the winner of the Mohammed Cartoon Contest, and also known for his great series called Pig Man. Andrew, Bosch, nice to have you.
Good to be
here. Good to be here. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, this is a very somber episode, but things need to be said,
Yes. Frankly.
Coming up on 20 years since the original attack that murdered roughly 3,000 people, what do you think, what do you two gentlemen think we've accomplished, if anything? Is our foreign policy a complete failure, or what should we do? How should we think about this?
But Bosch, you're the expert on Islam. Maybe you should go first.
Well, I mean, it's just it's the refusal of those in power to name the enemy, to identify it, and to do what needs to be done to defeat them. From Bush to Obama, even, you know, Trump had his moments in terms of taking out ISIS in a lot of ways, but he wasn't even as honest as we would expect or hope our leaders to be. So yeah, it's a refusal to understand the enemy, to identify Islam as its actual ideology, and not alleged deviant forms of it, called, as some objectivists say, Islamic totalitarianism, or some conservatives say, Islamofascism. They basically, they are scared to name the ideology that is motivating this enemy. And that's the first problem. If you can't call the enemy by its actual name, you can't defeat it. You can't even begin to defeat it. You can't begin to do what needs to be done. So I think that's the base. I mean, we have to understand the ideology, what is motivating them explicitly, not what we project onto the enemy, because we call them Islamists, we call them Islamic totalitarians, we call them all these names. They call themselves Muslims. Osama bin Laden called himself a Muslim. He didn't call himself an extremist Muslim, an Islamist, an Islamic totalitarian, radical Muslim. He was a Muslim following the Quran. And when the prophet of Islam was a warlord, this is what happens. The most devout followers follow in his steps, and they become warlords themselves. They become warriors. They become, you know, murderers. So we have to understand that it is the ideology of Islam itself, not any deviant or political forms of it or militant, because Islam is inherently political. It is inherently, you know, militant. I'm sorry, you were going to say, Andrew.
Yeah, I just want to jump in, you know, with the history here, and remember that great line. I don't remember the quote verbatim from George Santayana, but to the effect that, you know, those who are ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it.
We should study history. Yeah.
Yeah. We should know the history of Islam. I think Islam is probably the most successful imperialist philosophy of history. You know, starting with the Prophet, his troops, you know, conquered Arabia and, you know, burst out of the Arabian Peninsula, conquered most of a great deal of Asia, held it in thrall for 1,000 years, you know, conquered the Middle East, conquered Spain in 711 AD, invaded France, the Ottoman Empire, present day Turkey, you know, invaded Eastern Europe, conquered, you know, Bosch's ancestors, right? And Albania, conquered Eastern and Central Europe, held most of it for centuries, you know, besieged Vienna twice, the last time in 1683, when they were defeated by John Sobieski, the Polish king, relieving Vienna, was September 11th, 1683. So that, that's a major date in history. Yep. The jihad subsided for a while, only because the West grew strong, not because the Muslims grew peaceful. 1683, the West is on the cusp of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. And you see the West make all these advances in science that made, you know, in economics, the economy and the military that made it much stronger than the Ottoman Empire or the Islamic world. But that dream to conquer, especially Europe, to conquer the West, but also to conquer the world, that nightmare vision has always been, you know, a leitmotif or a theme in Islam. It's the one true faith. It's got to dominate the entire world. And we see it reborn in the 20th century. Ironically, when the West militarily is stronger than ever and vastly stronger than the Islamic world, but sure, where the West is now morally weak. And what, yeah, you got to give the Europeans credit, as much as I despise them in many ways. They defended themselves against Islam for centuries and often effectively. And the Crusades were actually a defensive war to stem the imperialist tide of Islam. But the Europeans don't have the will to defend themselves against Islam anymore. And the Americans are losing the will. And one last point I want to make on this is to compare and contrast with World War II. In World War II, we faced an enemy that was militarily powerful who could possibly have defeated us. Japan and Germany were powerful alliance. Today, we face an enemy who can't possibly defeat us if we were willing to fight. But in World War II, we had the will to win. Like Bas said, we had the will to victory. And we don't have that. We don't have that will anymore. And morality trumps military power.
100%.
Yeah.
Yes.
We don't have the moral strength to use our power to defeat our enemies. And like Bas said, to even name the enemy. Mm. We don't have the moral strength to even name the enemy, never mind defeat him.
Yep. Absolutely. Well put, Andrew.
Thank you.
Blair. Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
Ad that published sometime after September 11 by Dr. Leonard Peikoff and others in big newspapers. Could you please tell a little about that for the listeners? And do you think that will come when it's 20 years after the fact?
I don't even remember it, Bas. Do you
I do. Oh, yeah. Leonard, and it was probably, I don't know if it was ARI as much as Leonard himself. He published the article called End States That Sponsor Terrorism. Basically, he was highlighting the Saudis and the Iranians. Yeah. And they are the greatest, you know, sponsor of terrorism. Iran is the greatest state sponsor of terrorism on earth. The Saudis, you could argue that they're the greatest, one of the greatest sponsors, if not state sponsor, because they do hide behind a lot of the the Saudis who basically support jihad, but not on official terms. So that's one distinction between the two states that you could argue, but they're the two big ones. Without them, there is no Al Qaeda. There is no none of these groups. They need that kind of funding, and they need that kind of support. And without those two, Leonard, you know, pointed out that they have to be taken out by any means necessary. And it was an important point to be made. And people still argue about it today. Well, how about these independent? I said, yeah, but they wouldn't exist without these states. And you found out after the fact, after 9/11, that Iran and the Saudis were both involved with supporting Al Qaeda and 9/11 and the attacks on 9/11. And of course, they lie about it. But this is a fact that they were actually involved with them. And people say, well, how about the Sunnis and the Shias? They work together. BS. When it comes to us, they are brothers. They will work. It's like, you know, they have the same base, regardless of their differences. It's like the Nazis and the communists. It's the same base. It's just that their particular form of totalitarianism is a slightly little different, and they want to be in charge with no rivals. That's the only difference between the two. But when it comes to us, the Saudis and Iranians worked with Al Qaeda in order to hit us on 9/11, and they got away with it.
Yeah, Bas, you're absolutely right. How many times did Mohammed Atta and his co-conspirators visit Iran, presumably, for terrorist training?
Absolutely right. They absolutely did.
Yeah.
Over and over again, he was from. They had a little mix of. There were Egyptians, there were Saudis, there were other ones across. But it didn't matter. Again, it doesn't matter if the Sunnis or Shiites. They are Muslims. And just another aspect here that we overlook. There have been over 230,000 human beings who've been murdered in the name of Islam since 9/11. And that is from the religionofpeace.com, which is a website that I frequent. Every week, there's a few hundred who were murdered. And that was the compilation of it. It's 230,000 since 9/11.
And that's all over the world, right?
That's all over the world, exactly. And that's why we tend to forget, if we're not hitting America, that people just forget about the jihad. Every single week, there are hundreds of human beings who are murdered in the name of Islam across the world. Every single week, whether it's a dozen countries, 20 countries, whatever it is. And that is because we have refused to do our job and defend ourselves by crippling this threat, by ending the threat once and for all. And again, the unwillingness of even the best of us to come to terms with the truth about this and the true nature of Islam That's a problem because I even assumed after 9/11 that objectives would be at the vanguard of taking on this enemy, at least ideologically, to set the stage for it. Even they weren't willing to call Islam the ideology that motivates the jihadists, which pissed me off then, and it pissed me off now even more so because we're 20 years removed, and this enemy is still murdering Americans and with impunity. They knew that they can kill those Americans and get away with it. Last week, 2 weeks ago, they knew that. And what happened? They are getting away with it.
Right. I can go back a little bit further. I think it was 1989 when the Ayatollah Khomeini threatened Salman Rushdie with death.
Yes, you know, he did.
His book, Satanic Verses. And Leonard Peikoff, I remember, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling on the U.S. government to defend freedom of speech.
And Bush didn't do anything.
Right.
He actually bent over and said something along, we have to respect religion and something really weak, just like his son.
Yeah.
It was discussed in Europe also in the Swedish Academy with the literature society there and so on. And also, of course, the translators there in different countries there were attacked. And also, I think
there was a Japanese translator who was murdered. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Right. Now, you asked if we expect anything like that today. Unfortunately, I do not. I mean, Leonard Peikoff might. But other than that, I think today, 20 years after 9/11, the United States has moved ideologically leftward a great deal. We're much further enmeshed in the sick, evil philosophy of the left. And they hate America. They're not willing to defend America. You can see Biden's very pathetic response in Afghanistan. And part of their ideology is multiculturalism, and every culture is equal. And if you assert that Western civilization is better because it's more life promoting, you're a racist. We're heavily sunk in that mire of leftist philosophy, and that's what I was saying before. We don't have the moral will to defend America anymore or Western values, and it's really, really, really sad. Not only because I think let me just say 1 minute here on what I think we should do. One, obviously, militarily, we have to wage. And I know you're interested in just war theory, and I will get to that. But sure. Militarily, we have to wage all out war against our main enemies. And Bosch is right. The primary enemy here is the Iranian regime, and Bush invaded the wrong country.
Right.
But in addition to that, we need to wage and win philosophic war like we did against the fascist powers in World War II. And like, Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America waged philosophic war against communism, the Soviets during the Cold War. I would have Atlas Shrugged translated into every language of the Arab Islamic world and then airdrop millions of copies.
Well done.
Whatever the expense, it would be worth it to defend America and Western civilization against these Islamic savages. Continue to airdrop millions of copies of Atlas Shrugged into every quadrant of every Arab Islamic country in the world and be committed to doing it for decades, maybe centuries, if necessary. We have to wage and win the philosophic war as well as military.
Yeah, it is a two-pronged war. Absolutely. Yes,
absolutely.
Well said. Wow, where do I go from that? Well, let's do touch on the just war theory. To me, that's like, well, you really can't defend yourself because you don't want to offend your quote enemy, unquote. Is that too simplistic or?
No, that's exactly right. It's a religious aspect in there brought in there. It's altruism brought in there. It's basically trying to cripple yourself and try. And again, this is something that I've been discussing with Andrew on a show where you got these people. They think they're too good to be morally ruthless against their enemies when they're not good enough. And that's part of what that thinking is. It's like, I am too good to think of these terrible things about these people. I have to wish them better. I have to think that they're better when they're not.
Yeah.
And that's also, that is a self-crippling move. And again, as soon as Bush burped out Islam is peace post 9/11, I knew that the war, we were crippled at that point. We were crippled morally, militarily. This guy is just a coward, and he was a born-again Christian, so of course he had to respect this other religion, right? He couldn't call it what it was. And instead of saying Islam means peace, he should have said, look, I don't know what the hell Islam means. Let's find out as a nation. Let's figure this all out. Instead of declaring what it isn't, just say, I don't know. I don't know. and let's find out. Instead, he's he was a typical born-again Christian trying to, basically be an altruist when it comes to war. After he sees nearly 3,000 Americans get slaughtered on our shores and jumping from those towers. And to me, that should be an image that should be used every so often, just be brought up to show this is the horror that we witness, and this is the horror that we have to keep in mind at times.
I've never forgotten it.
Never. You know, guys, going all the way back to when Jimmy Carter, another born-again Christian, was president, another feckless, pathetic creature who let the Ayatollah Khomeini knock him down and dance all over his face with impunity. Peter Schwartz, I think, was writing in The Intellectual Activist then, and Peter said that Carter's attitude was turn the other country. funny, but accurate. Getting back to just war theory, I want to apologize here because it's a philosophic theory it's in my field, and I don't know it that well. I believe it. One of its originators was St. Augustine, wasn't it? I think he was one of the. I could be wrong on this, but anyway, I know this. Part of just war theory, there's other parts to it, but one aspect of it is the idea that my response to aggression must be commensurate to the amount of force that the aggressor uses. And you think about that, that's just insane. I mean, if some guy's advancing on me, let's say he's a big, strong guy. He wants to beat me to death with his fists. I have a gun. Just war theory would bring it down to real world, sea level, I think of it, because I'm just a kid from Brooklyn. I am not morally obliged to fight it out with him, bare knuckles. If I have a gun, I'm going to aim it at his chest and tell him to cease and desist. And if he doesn't, I'm gonna shoot him through the heart and kill him because I'm fighting in self-defense. I have the moral high ground. He's the aggressor, and he's the one who's morally wrong. And it's just flat out false to believe that somebody who's defending their life and liberty has to respond only when they're much more powerful than the aggressor, has to limit their response to only the amount of force that the aggressor uses. I think the West and the United States in particular should use the full might of its military to wipe out the Iranian regime. Should have done it in 1979. But better late than never. Do it today. Wipe out the regime of the Ayatollahs. Obliterate, wipe out the Iranian military capacity and their capacity to fund state terror. These independent terrorist organizations. And when the smoke clears, let's see, what the jihadists say there. Yeah, and then we can go after ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. But the Iranian regime has to be taken out, completely destroyed militarily. And at the same time, I want to reiterate, we need to fight philosophic war, as well as military war, like I said before.
One thing also, sorry, just one little observation in terms of the just war theory. Wasn't it implemented by the Kennedy administration? And since then, we have been able to win wars.
It seems to be because, we surrendered in Vietnam, we withdrew and
failed. Isn't that, you could call it you talked about the Europeans, Andy, but one time, the British, they said this gunboat diplomacy. Okay, we know our defense, and if you attack, we'll
take you out.
We'll take you out.
That's why, speaking of gunboat diplomacy.
So-called diplomatic way.
Right, gunboat diplomacy. Yeah. That was the policy of President Theodore Roosevelt roughly 120 years ago. And it's funny, after 9/11, I thought to myself, who would I want of all the presidents of history? Who would I want to be president of the United States now? And my answer to that was Teddy Roosevelt, because he would have used the full might of the U.S. military to destroy our enemies in the Middle East. And as several objectivist friends of mine said to me, he said, you're right, Andy, but then Roosevelt would have wanted to colonize the Middle East. I said, well, you take the bitter with the sweet. But Roosevelt would have, Teddy Roosevelt, would have defended the United States. Remember, one historic point near the end of his presidency, 1908, 1909, something like that. He had, and mostly in response to Japan's growing naval power and their victory over Russia in the Russian-Japanese War. He had the U.S. Navy. Back then, battleships were the bulwark of a navy. He had the U.S. Navy build these tremendous, battleships. I think Carnegie Steel was Carnegie had sold Carnegie Steel by that time, but very likely U.S. Steel was making the steel for those battleships. Had them painted white. They called it the Great White Fleet. I don't know if there's any racist element to that or not. But they sailed the world. There's enormously powerful fleet into every harbor, a purely diplomatic visit. They met with the local leaders and everything, and it was peaceful and diplomatic. But you see the underlying message. You bleep with the United States, and you're going to have to deal with the most powerful fleet that's ever been built. As one, I think one journalist said, Teddy Roosevelt's intention was to teach the Japanese a lesson in polite behavior. And and it did for 20 years or so. You know, it was effective. So, yeah, what was Roosevelt's phrase? Walk softly and carry a big stick. And carry a big stick. Yeah, you don't want to, as you know, I say as an objectivist, we believe in morally banning the initiation of force. So we're not going to use that big stick aggressively. But when we're attacked, we're going to use the big stick to beat the bejesus out of anybody.
Obliterate them.
Obliterate them. Yeah, I agree, Bosch. Obliterate them.
Great.
Sorry, you guys keep sparking things. You mind if I just jump in one?
Jump for it. Go for it.
Barbary Wars, our first encounter with Muslims, with jihadists. The Muslim pirates who were sacking our ships. It was late 1700s, early 1800s.
Right.
And what was the response of the statesmen in those days, like Jefferson and Adams? Their response was to read the Quran, go in Congress and explain to them what they understood about the ideology that was facing them at that point. And that's where the Marines were born. I think, technically speaking, that's what the Marines were worn. And I think it's part of the song.
From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Tripoli's, the Barbary Pirates.
And they basically took them out, and they were quiet for a while, the Muslims, at that point, at least when it came to America, until we got weak and soft. But I just wanted to mention that, because it's just, I mean, this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, it's a good point, true. Bosch. And you know, the United States was a new republic, small population, didn't have much of a navy, you know, at all at that point. But it was a pioneer country, and the Barbary pirates, who were satraps to the Sultan, you know, of the Ottoman Empire, they demanded tribute for the ships that they robbed and the slaves that they took. And the phrase in American history then, a phrase that was popular, you know, in America then was millions for defense, not a penny for tribute.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. The Americans, we're going to build a Navy. Like you said, Bosch, we're going to start the Marines, who are, you know, basically the fighting, you know, the soldiers on the Marine vessels. And we're going to go to war with these guys, you know, millions for defense, not a penny for tribute. Yes, that was the spirit. That was the American spirit 200 years ago. Unfortunately, that has been significantly lost.
These were learned men who understood that they have to find out who the hell this enemy is. They did their homework. Unlike Bush, when he has a Quran in his hand, right? He goes, "Hey, this is the first Quran in the White House." He puts it on a shelf. Of course, he didn't read it, but he made a big deal about it. You know.
Yeah, you're right. Jefferson studied Islam. He studied the Quran to know what he was dealing with.
John Quincy Adams as well.
John Quincy Adams.
Okay. Yes, and John Adams. But you know, through that, and he said some pretty damning things about Islam itself. John Quincy Adams, I think, what was he, the 6th, 7th, or was he even later than that? I think president. He was.
I don't remember what number, but yeah, late 1820s, right?
Okay.
He was right.
Yeah, he and John Adams, the only father sons, you know, who were both the presidents in U.S. history.
Right, until you know, the Bush.
Oh, what, Obama? The Bush thing of Obama and Biden.
That's right.
But big Bush and little Bush. That's right. We can't forget that.
So sorry, Blair Martin, if you want to chime in, because you got me rolling, guys.
So we have a corollary then. We have a correlation between altruism, which is the morality of self-sacrifice, and just war theory. What has happened over the last 20 years or longer, even since Vietnam, I would assume. I'm going to bring up some grim statistics, though, since 9/11/2001. In military alone, 30,700 and change suicides, over 300,000 wounded physically and psychologically, 7,000 were killed. We've spent $2 trillion. That's $300 million a day, every day, for 20 years. For what? Now, I don't want to be cynical, but for what?
No.
And 55,000 American servicemen dead in Vietnam.
That's right.
You know, for what? You're raising an important question. A few years ago, I was shocked when I saw that film, Thank You for Your Service, with Miles Teller, which I thought was good. Yeah, it's a powerful, powerful movie. Yeah, and they ran the graphic at the end that something like, I forget what it was, something like 20 U.S. vets on average commit suicide every day. It was something.
Yes.
That's horrifying.
It's hard to believe, but it's true.
I had to pick my jaw up off the floor. And I think what you guys at Martin and Blair, what you're saying is absolutely the cause of it. The rules of engagement that constrain our forces from attaining victory. You fight and die with one hand, maybe, you know, one hand and one leg tied behind your back. There's no chance of victory. All these guys killed, wounded, maimed, go through these horrifying experiences with no chance to win. I mean, back in the day, they had an expression, what they call, you know, shell shock, they called it, for people who just psychologically crushed by warfare. And I think that's true in any war. War is hell, like Sherman said. Mm-hmm. You know, the shell-shocked veterans of World War II or World War I or whatever war is, that's one reason of many why you try to avoid war as much as possible, because war is hell, and you're going to lose a lot of your guys, and the survivors very often going to be psychologically scarred for the rest of their lives. But at the very least, you go to war. Here's the two things about war, I think. One, you go to war only when you absolutely have to in order to defend your life and liberty. And then two, you fight with all your might to win the war. And
at least
these guys who died then, who died, and the others who were psychologically scarred, or they're maimed or killed or psychologically scarred, at least it wasn't for nothing. You know, at least it protected American life and liberty. It wasn't for nothing, like all these wars we've seen over the last 50 years or so.
Blair, but I have one that could be a segue, and also for our name of a show, the Secular Foxhole, what we are sitting in here, Manning. During the time here, and we are thinking, we have an idea to reach out to the military, the free thinkers in the military. You did a post here, Andrew, on your Facebook page, and I will start out reading, and you could fill out the rest here. As the left rams its destructive agenda down the throats of Americans, conservatives increasingly blame the Democrats' failures on secularism, on a lack of God. Will America undergo a powerful religious backlash against the left's vicious insanity? And then we talk about Leonard Peikoffer in a good way. Could you comment a bit about that, how it is with the situation today? And if you're not a religious person in military today, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, I understand, you know, Leonard Peikoffer, you know, and for those who don't know, Leonard Peikoff, he's, you know, he's, in my judgment, he's the world's greatest living philosopher. He was Ayn Rand's leading student, and I think everybody should read his books, The Ominous Parallels and Objectivism Philosophy of Ayn Rand. Dr. Peikoff's been warning for years that religion is the long-term threat to liberty in the United States. You know, I've disagreed with him. I think the left is, certainly in the short term, it is. I think, I don't want to put words in Dr. Peikoff's mouth, but I think short term, I think he agrees, since he voted for Trump and he supported, donated to the Trump campaign. I think he recognizes that in the short term, anyway, the left is the imminent threat. He may or may not be right long term about the greater danger of religion. And I'm old enough to remember, you know, when Ayn Rand refused to support Ronald Reagan and pleaded with her supporters not to vote for Reagan. As much as I love Ayn Rand, I voted for Reagan, and I would vote for Reagan in a heartbeat today, you know, against the lunatic left. But look, religion is dangerous.
He opened the door for the, certain.
Yeah, religion is dangerous. There's no question. Yeah. I understood Ayn Rand's reason. She said the only, you know, whatever short-term gains, as opposed to Carter, would be more than wiped out by long-term association in people's minds of capitalism with Christianity. And I, you know, I knew she was right. But, you know, also we have to survive. We have to survive in the moment. And
to make it more complicated, Andy, we have a new religion also, and that's environmentalism. So if we take that into account, it's pretty dangerous situation. But please continue.
Yes. You know, and when I was, when Yaron Brook interviewed me on his show a year or so ago, he made an interesting point. I don't remember exactly what Yaron said, but it was something to the effect that what really scares me, he said, was something like some charismatic candidate coming along who merges Christianity with environmentalism. You know, and I can understand that, because, you know, Al Gore was like that to some degree, because he was a devout Christian and he was a devout environmentalist, and he thought that
but he was a bore.
Yeah, right. He wasn't charismatic.
And Andy, right. Bosch, for your information, Blair, I booed at him when he came to college one time.
Oh, nice.
During MTV. You know, choose or lose campaign, and there he was there. And then Bush was waving from his ranch and so on. Yeah, it was a drama. So,
yeah, but Gore was a combination of that. That his idea was.
And his wife also. She was against the censorship.
Yeah, Tipper Gore. Right, right. To censor the lyrics on records, correct. But, you know, he saw Gore. His belief was that God gave us the earth to shepherd. We should be the shepherds of the earth. And that wasn't the word he used. I forget what it was. But we needed to take care. You know, we're caretakers. We have to, you know, take care of the earth. And I can understand your fear. You're right. Gore was a bore. But some charismatic candidate with Obama's charisma or combines those two. Could well be the gravest threat, but
it could be.
Yeah, but we.
But at the same time, sorry, just that I think we have so many threats, so many concrete threats, individuals and whatnot, and that those type of things, I wouldn't even worry about those. At least at this point, and that's why what you were reading before, Martin, was actually a description that Andrew wrote for our episode last week that we had, and something happened to the episode. It was deleted. I don't know what they'll happen, but it was a really good episode. And it was basically, we were discussing this potential problem right now where you got these allegedly political voices. They're allegedly, you know, they have political shows, but they are really, the religiosity is coming out in ways that is starting to concern me. When they start talking about my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, in the middle of a political show, I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Yes. And they keep pushing it, and they keep talking about God is the answer. Secularism is the enemy. It's like, what the hell's going on here? These guys are having political shows, and they keep shoving their religiosity onto it. Mm. That's a problem. And I just wanted to, you know, mention that, because it's something that I think that's a problem, because they think that's the answer to the left, and it's not.
Could you re-record that episode for the future so we can link to it?
I imagine it's still available on some, but we just got to get it back on, because I don't know.
It might be available on Rumble. I have to ask.
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, it might be available. I'll ask our tech guy, see what we could do about it.
It was about an hour and a half. It was really good, and I was happy with it. I mean, as I am with all the episodes, we always take on these subjects that are considered taboo, and it's always fun to do it. So yeah, hopefully it'll be on there soon.
I just want to piggyback on what you're saying, Bosch, and that is, if Leonard Peikoff turns out to be right, and you know, I can't predict the future. Nobody can. But we speculate. We do the best we can.
Sure.
If religion is the ultimate, you know, a theocracy and a religious dictatorship of some kind is America's ultimate fate, and right now we're moving towards dictatorship. There's no question about it.
Right.
We're moving towards a basically secular socialist one right now. But if religion hijacks that, we ultimately become a theocracy. I say it's going to be in reaction against the vicious anti-Americanism and the viciousness of the left. Mm. That's going to fuel a religious revival in this country, as Bosch said, because the religionists can appeal to the American people. The left is viciously insane and hates you, believes that white people are all racist and white people are all evil. You know, they've abandoned God. That's why they're satanic. That's why they're so vicious. And, you know, some point down the road, it's possible we get that kind of religious revival. But if we do, it's going to be in response to the absolute off-the-charts evil to which the left has devolved.
What do they think about us then when we talk about this issue?
Right. Right. I mean,
well, they don't have very high hopes for us, I guess.
No.
I mean, us, you know. Us, you mean objectivists?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're such a small percentage of the population. I don't think they really have to.
But they are afraid of Rand. They are afraid of her ideas because they know that Ayn Rand's ideas can take them out.
That's true.
They really know that. And that's why they go after her hard sometimes and ignore her at the same time. So it's just back
and forth. That's true. And that will give me a good segue into ending the show on a decent note or a great note. In spite of all the issues that face us, in spite of all the horrible things that have happened and are happening, there is an answer. And it's not Jesus. It is the science of philosophy. Yeah. And specifically, even though I think Miss Rand herself was too, I won't say she was too humble when she said that it was philosophy that got us into this mess, it is only philosophy that will get us out. I think she was too humble to say it's only her philosophy that will get us out. That's my personal view.
Totally agree.
I agree.
And I agree. We'll hold hope for that it's spread. I know that there's a solid toehold, if not a foothold, in some of the universities in America. And her popularity, I know that I have been, since I first read the first page of The Fountainhead in March of 1979, and Atlas Shrugged right after that, I have been a flame spotter. And I've introduced 35 people to her novels, and all but one have thanked me profoundly, profusely for introducing her to them.
Good job by you, Blair.
And I plan on doing that to my last breath. This show is another avenue that we will exploit her ideas with. And
I mean, you're right. Ayn Rand has already done the heavy lifting.
That's right. First of all, I love that heavy lifting.
Yeah. Two things. First of all, she created this rational philosophy. She's revolutionized the field of philosophy. But two, also, she presented her philosophy in the two greatest novels ever written. You don't have to wade through hundreds of pages of technical philosophy to get her point. You could read these two amazing stories. And, you know, although The Fountainhead's my all-time favorite book, Atlas Shrugged, I think objectively by literary principles, is the greatest – it's the greatest story ever told. It's a mystery.
It's absolutely true.
And furthermore, it's not only been translated into like every language in the world practically, but people all over the world read English. They can read Ayn Rand in the original. So Ayn Rand's already done the heavy lifting. Our job now is to, like you said, Blair, to get people to know about Ayn Rand's books, to introduce them to Ayn Rand's books, to give them physical copies of Ayn Rand's books and be there to talk to them if they have questions and such. But Ayn Rand's already done the hard part. It's our part now is to advertise her accomplishments. And you know what else to do? To live it out in real life, to live like an Ayn Rand hero.
That's right. You could do it in different ways. And that's why, you do it your show. And I will now, I interrupt you a bit, because Andy, I like your speaking and being both on the soapbox and doing your presentation and conferences. And I remember you said once, we will do a new sandwich segment that Amy Pico said, you know, we will have that in our own solo show, not solo, but duo shows. We introduced that during our anniversary here. And there it was, you say something good and then you say something that's not so good in the news and then end in a good note. But I remember you said that the talk about The Fountain and Atlas, it was like the Old and the New Testament, I think.
That was me. Yeah, right.
The headline in today's newspaper, it was something going on in America regarding women's right and attack against abortion clinics. And I personally it could be some few crackpots and others, but couldn't that be a threat? And could you explain what's going on? And then we should end on a good note, what you are doing, Bosch, and what you are doing, Andy. So please comment on what's going on right now in Texas and regarding abortion.
Bosch, you're probably more familiar with the immediate day-to-day politics. You want to
I want to gather. I don't know enough about it. I just heard about it the old day. There was some they're finding a way to try to make abortion illegal. And they have an argument, and I don't know exactly what the argument was, but they're trying to say you cannot get an abortion after 6 weeks after the heartbeat, and it's actually putting the left on their heels because they don't know how to answer it right now. They got to figure it out. But basically, it's this religiosity that I've been referring to, this growing religiosity by the right, who are trying to, this is all they have. This is their only answer to the left is their religiosity. And they want to take that issue away from the left about abortion. they're going to try to make it illegal, not just in Texas, across the entire country for religious reasons.
And Rand had the answer that also. She had answered that on a question. So I'm getting very scared about this news. I'm absolutely worried.
You know, because I've been saying for years that generally the religious conservatives are less bad than the leftists. I still think that's true because I'm not a one issue voter. But this is a major issue, and I want to confront the conservatives on this and point out, you know, sometimes you guys conservatives stand up for individual rights, which the leftists never do.
Never.
Well, if you're going to be consistent individual rights, you have got to respect the most fundamental right of all, and that is a human being's right to his or her own body. In this case, a woman's right to her own body, that she is an individual. The fetus, certainly in those first 3 months or maybe the first 6 months of the pregnancy, is still a clump of protoplasm within a woman's womb. It's not yet dependent on the mother's life support systems. It's not yet an individual. If you're not going to stand up for individual rights in this case, then you're not an individualist. You're not a supporter of individual rights. And then what makes you morally better than the left?
Absolutely.
And, you know, we have to challenge the conservatives
good.
On this.
And please do that.
This is how this is horrifying.
Doing it. Because it's hasn't horrifying. This becoming like almost like a litmus test in the Republican Party, the GOP?
I think
that
it is.
You can't say
been,
anything.
I think, yeah.
There's also this idea about when the language they speak also about the quote unquote unborn, they speak of it in hushed tones as if it's
and support like a baby. Pro-life. Is
yes,
it pro-choice, pro-life.
Yes, well, that's how they define it. They're right; they call it pro-life. But this idea and the language, think about the nomenclature when they say the sacred unborn, and that has to do with, I believe, with original sin, because maybe, you know, before it's born, it's pure and perfect. After it's born, you know, not so much. It's
not so much.
My life.
Yeah, we start to sin after that.
Yes, right.
But, you're born in sin. Yes,
exactly. As soon as you pop out, so that's also an aspect. But I just every time I mention this, right, on Facebook, whatever, I get. Yeah, I mean, people who are patrons of Patreon, boom, take out their patronage from me. They condemn me. It is what it is. It's such, and they become like absolute irrational leftists when it comes to this one issue. To the point where there was a guy from National Review actually saying that women should be executed who have abortions.
Really?
He said this.
In National Review?
Kevin Williamson. Now, I believe he was at National Review at a time where he was writing for another publication outside of that, but he went back to National Review. And he said that. And I called him out for it, and I got heat for it. People actually liked it. I said, you like this guy saying they should execute innocent women who have abortions? I said, this is madness.
That's as bad as anything the left.
It is. It's madness.
Yeah, that's absolutely. That's vicious. Now, we have to call the conservatives out on this, because if they don't stand up for
individual rights. You got to nip that in the bud right away when you hear it. You have to.
If they don't stand up for a woman's right to her own body on this issue, then they cannot build themselves as supporters of individual rights. And they're morally no better than the left at that point.
Absolutely right. And then it's just two bad guys fighting it out.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Well, I thought we were going to end on a good note.
Yes. So Andy and Bart,
how about
thanks
truth
for your work. Yeah.
But everything you've said is true, of course.
Yes, it is.
Check out my and Andy's show, Truth and Pulse.
Please.
We do it live every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern on Facebook. And then it ends up at Rumble. You can check out our channel there. We have 29 episodes so far. Love it. I love doing it. With Andrew, we always take on these topics that are considered taboo, even amongst some objectivists, I got to say, which I really, really appreciate. And check out my work, boschfossenstore.blogspot.com. My Pigman comic books, I have about 100 prints. I have 7 books now. Yeah, so check it out. I got this a series called Peaceful Death Threats. It's basically a collection of a lot of the death threats I've gotten, where with the death threats.
Peaceful death threats. I love it.
Yeah. And basically, because I've literally gotten death threats for saying, I'm going to rape you and then I'm going to murder you. And Islam is a religion of peace. And they actually say this.
Oh.
They say this. So I use that in my book. And then I have another book on Islamophiles. And anyway, check it out. And also, Andrew, you got a website. And if you want to talk about that also.
Yeah. I just want to say, I think Bosch Forston's a hero. I mean, he stands up. These death threats, and he draws Muhammad, and he speaks out against Islam because he recognizes, you know, freedom of speech and, you know, and liberty. Well, liberty is at stake. And I love the Pigman comic books. And I would go up on Bosch's website and buy Pigman. Yeah, you're welcome. As for me, you know, I have a collection of short stories coming out, the Brooklyn Stories, that'll be out in a few months. If I say so myself, there's some pretty good stories.
It really is great.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you, Bosch. You know, I've written 2 hard-boiled detective novels that I haven't published yet, but, you know, the Tony Just saga, but, you know, Voyage Media, Hollywood production company, has completed the script. The script is done for 4 dramatic audio podcasts for the Tony Just.
So wow. So that should be
out, you know, on all the audio platforms sometime in the fall. So I'm very happy about those 2 things. You know, my book, Heroes, Legends, Champions, came out last year, and with John Hersey, and now with Robert Begley, I do the Hero Show, you know, every day, which you can find us on YouTube. So they keep me busy, guys. You know, they keep me busy, and we do the show with Bosch on politics, which is outstanding. It's fun.
I love it, and
I'm working on a book on American education on how it sank into the pits but mostly how we can fix it. Because that's the real battle. That's the real battle, is to win in the educational system. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing these days. It's very positive.
Again, we've had Andrew Bernstein and Bosch Fosten as our guests today. Gentlemen, thanks for manning the foxhole with us.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Blair and Martin. I greatly appreciate it.
All right, guys. Thanks.